Hi, I'm Cliff Muncy with the North Carolina American Republic, and I'm here today on the phone with one of our citizens, Milo Townsend. Milo just recently appeared in court. Milo, first of all, introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about why you're a part of the North Carolina American Republic, and what's your perspective on why you're going into court?
Okay. My name is Milo Townsend, and I've been a citizen, a state citizen of the de jure state of North Carolina since January of 2013. I've been involved in politics and political issues for a long time, and as part of the liberty movement, so to speak. But for most of that time, I had spent my efforts within the de facto system because I was unaware of the Reconstruction Acts themselves. I knew that they existed, but I was unaware of their full import and consequences. And the more I dug into things, investigating and learning, actually eventually learned that they are key, critical turning point. They are pretty much the turning point for when this current nation ceased to be a federal constitutional republic and became a nation, a completely different political animal. So my reason for becoming involved was because I've always had, you know, a love of lawful government. I want to return to genuine constitutional government, and I fought for that in the best way I knew how for a long time. But this came to my attention, and I realized that this was the best way. The truth is always the best thing to stand upon. That's why I'm involved.
What does this have to do with a lot of the modern-day issues that we have nowadays, like people fighting the health care laws and gun control, abortion, NDAA, privacy concerns, things like this? What does what you're doing have to do with these modern-day concerns?
Well, the nationalization of citizenship is the underlying legal issue. The Reconstruction Acts were really a tool used by Congress to ultimately impose the 14th Amendment on all the people that lived in America. And prior to that time, 1868, and roughly 2-year period there, all of the people in all of the various states had been state citizens first, and their federal citizenship status was really kind of just, it wasn't a legal status, it was really just sort of you're a citizen of the state, the state was a member of the Union, so therefore you were a citizen also of these United States in kind of an informal sense. But the nationalization of citizenship was made formal by the 14th Amendment, and ultimately that subjected all of those people to the supreme jurisdiction of Congress or the federal government generally. Now people think that they're still living under constitutional government, that they have constitutional rights, et cetera, but really the fact is that they're kind of subjects to the will of Congress, and that will is virtually unlimited. That's the legal situation that they find themselves in today.
Well, Milo, as many of us know, we can go super in-depth with the history. There's a lot more to learn. And I guess for now, I'm going to refer people to americasremedy.com. That's an educational site. And, of course, the ncrepublic.org is the website for the North Carolina American Republic, if you want to look into this more. But for right now, I want to go into your court appearance, because you had an appearance today, yesterday, as well as the day before. Weren't you in there 3 days in a row?
I was 3 days in a row to resolve one minor pretrial technical issue.
What, first of all, I guess, what was the situation that pulled you into the court system, and what is your challenge to the court?
Okay. Well, the actual issue that drew me into court was I was detained. I was actually arrested at a random DUI checkpoint in Locust, and it was probably 1:30 in the morning back in early March. I can't recall the exact date, but it was the Locust PD and the Stanley County Sheriff's Department were doing a joint DUI checkpoint there, and I came upon it coming back from Charlotte, pulled up to the first officer that was standing in the middle of the road, ahead, I guess, and disclose that a big part of this story involves a firearm, not that there was any violence involved. I'm not that kind of person at all. But I do have a CCW permit from the de facto state, and I kind of waver back and forth between what that means and how I, you know, whether or not I want to maintain it or not. I ultimately want that permit, but then at the same time, I'm not a citizen of that state. So it's kind of a tricky issue, as are a lot of issues that we have to deal with as state citizens.
So you're a state citizen, but you're not a citizen of that state. So there are two states.
By state citizen, I mean a citizen of the de facto or of the de jure state of North Carolina, the original lawful state, and that is the citizenship status that I have taken an oath to and sworn to now.
Okay, I think there might be some confusion with when people say de jure, de facto, but just for reference purposes, de jure is a legal term meaning essentially the lawful state as put in place by the original people, and then the de facto is a system that was put in place coercively or under force, which is what we identify with what was put in place, the state of North Carolina that was put in place with the Reconstruction Acts, which we deem as unlawful. Is that right?
Right. The first one, de jure, just simply is a French legal term meaning of law, and the second one, de facto, is simply a term meaning of fact.
Okay.
So one is in fact there, and the other is the lawful state. Getting back to the stop, I was detained for not having a proper tag, according to the de facto state. They want you to have a DMV issued license plate, of course, but not being a citizen of that state, I don't run with that license plate on the back of my vehicle anymore. So that's their probable cause, I guess, or whatever they require to begin to make a stop and investigate. And the officer ultimately wound up trying to take my firearm, which was a handgun, off the dash where I had placed it. And there are sticky issues about that, as I was saying. But in the process, there was a resisting charge for me trying to prevent that from occurring. Basically, I rolled my window up on the officer, and that was perhaps, in a way, a foolish thing to do. Ultimately, I wound up being arrested, so there was a resisting charge, and then there were the usual tags and insurance and those violations of their statutory code. So I went into court with those charges in front of me.
What is your first point of contact with that court? I know a lot of people, if they get tickets or they get fines or whatever, they go in, they pay the people, and then they leave. Now, so you do it a little bit differently.
Yeah. Actually, once I got the charges, the tickets and all that, I was arrested that night and paid my own bail. So I bailed myself out, and immediately afterwards I started putting together my paperwork that essentially outlines what all our challenge entails. Our issue is with the state, not with the court. And this, to me, seems very important, so it's worth a little short explanation. We serve notice, or at least I have been doing it this way. I serve notice to the state, or rather to the state's agent in that court in this county. The state's agent is the DA. So we put together a package which consists of a formal legal notice to the district attorney and an accompanying memorandum of law, which is really the heart of all of our outline and our argument. And we take this packet with any additional documentation, and we serve this notice, and it's, I call them attachments because they're not exhibits when you're dealing with the district attorney. They're only exhibits in court. So we serve this notice to the DA, and the DA is then responsible to respond to it. And that is the legal crux of the thing, is that the DA is required to respond to that notice before there really is any issue before the court. Now, of course, the courts don't see it that way. But
so the jurisdictional challenge that you're bringing up a jurisdictional challenge. You're saying this state calling itself North Carolina does not have jurisdiction over me because I'm a state citizen that was in that situation was never usurped by Reconstruction because it was unconstitutional. Therefore, your state and its laws don't apply to me. I'm challenging your jurisdiction. You have to answer this first before we can move on to the ticket and all these things that you've charged me with.
Right. The jurisdictional challenge has to be addressed before the facts of the so-called facts of the case, the actual you did such and such and we've got proof, all of that, before that can actually be tried.
Why are they required to answer this challenge of jurisdiction before they can get to the merits of the case? Why is that a requirement, and where do you find that?
Well, it's well established throughout case law, and actually it's also established within the statutory code of the de facto North Carolina state. But it's a long-standing legal tradition that pretty much is just, you know, common sense that any government that wants to file charges against or try someone for an alleged crime must have jurisdiction, and there's three kinds of jurisdiction. There's either territorial, subject matter, or personal, and they must have at least personal jurisdiction, which itself relies on one of the other two. But yeah, we challenge the territorial jurisdiction because essentially the de facto state is claiming that it has a blanket jurisdiction over anyone or anything that goes on in the territory of the state of North Carolina.
But in reality, they are only in charge over United States national citizens residing in the states under the 14th Amendment, which was coerced by Reconstruction.
Right, and that speaks to the personal jurisdictional issue. So because the de facto state was established through an act of treason, it lacks lawful title to exercise territorial jurisdiction over this state. And then pursuant to that, because personal jurisdiction relies on territorial jurisdiction, they lack territorial, therefore a citizen who has not given consent to the de facto state, which would be any lawfully declared state citizen, you know, that is to say lawfully declared de jure state citizen, has revoked their consent to that state, and therefore they're no longer subject to, they have revoked their consent to abide by or be bound or obligated by those state or that state's laws.
I want to take a break real quick, and when we come back, we will look a little bit deeper into these court appearances that you've had, because I want people to see the interesting things that have happened in here, and some of them a little sad, some of them a little humorous, that really shed some light on what's taking place inside the doors of these courtrooms. So Milo, we'll be right back. This is Cliff Muncy with the North Carolina American Republic, and I'm here with Milo Townsend. He's a state citizen in the Republic. And Milo, I want to go ahead and go through these court appearances that you had, and you had one today. But tell me about the first day that you went in. I guess this would be Monday?
It was Monday, yeah. This is Stanley County, and it was my first. I appealed the district court decision. It was pretty much an illegal trial. And so upon my appeal, they gave me a new court date for Superior Court and a brand new trial. And this time it's in a court of record. So I went into court on Monday, and the judge presiding over it was Judge Martin Marty McGee from Cabarrus County, and the district attorney, well, the assistant district attorney that was handling the cases in this particular court session was Robin Singletary. And I went in, and when my name was called, the calendar call, you know, they, of course, advised me of my rights and all that, and asked me what I wanted to do about counsel, because that's always really the first question that they want to deal with. And we really never made it past that. That was the pretrial issue I mentioned earlier that it took 3 days to resolve. So most of this is going to be an explanation, I guess, of why that took so long. But
so this is something that holds up a lot of our challenges, because they want to know if you What is it they want to know? If you have an attorney, if you need one provided by the court.
Yeah, if you, they advise you of your right to one and that they can provide one if you can't afford it, blah, 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 the typical. But then the thing is, our jurisdictional challenge is supposed to be the first thing that's dealt with. The state is required to answer that challenge and prove their jurisdiction before anything can proceed to a trial. So a state citizen going in there really doesn't know, honestly, if they need an attorney for the trial or not, because the state never provides an answer to the jurisdictional challenge. They never prove that they've even got the right to prosecute. So what I basically said to the judge, and, you know, said it in district, said it in superior, every time they ask me this question is, the state hasn't replied to my challenge yet, and I can't answer the question pertaining to an attorney because I have no idea.
You have no idea if you'll need one because you don't know if it's going to actually, if they're actually going to be able to prove jurisdiction or not.
Yeah, because the state just won't reply. They just remain mum on the whole thing.
So what was the outcome of day one?
In probably a five-hour period, I was called up 3 to 4 times. I can't remember exactly how many. But that in each of those times, I was asked the same question. My reply was always the same. By the end of the day, I had made a decision that I would appear pro se for the jurisdictional hearing, but I was adamant that I wanted to reserve the right to appear with counsel if I wanted counsel. For the trial, if it ever came to a trial, assuming the state could prove jurisdiction, I wanted to reserve the right to an attorney. But it was not satisfactory to the judge. The judge insisted that I either make a decision that I wanted court-appointed counsel or that I sign a waiver stating that I was waiving my right to counsel. And then by that, I could waive my right to court-appointed counsel specifically or to counsel altogether and just say, I'm going to represent myself. Well, I did not want to do either of those things, and the reason why is because there's a sentence at the bottom of the form, the waiver of counsel. The judge has a section where the judge is supposed to attest to what essentially is a mental state of the defendant. The judge is supposed to sign a sworn statement that the defendant has voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently elected in open court to be tried in this action. And the key word there is that the judge is attesting that the defendant has willfully elected to be tried. Now, wow. A trial is not a pretrial hearing. A trial is a trial. That's a trial of the facts.
So this would blows right past. This essentially gets you to sign and blow right past the challenging of jurisdiction of the state and goes right into the merits of the case.
Yes. I mean, when you sign that statement, well, when you sign above in your section and then hand that waiver of counsel to the judge and the judge signs that statement, that is essentially, in my opinion, and in the opinion of others as well, that's basically saying that you give consent to go to trial, that you are altering, forfeiting your special appearance, which is the challenge, and going directly into a general appearance, which is a general trial of or hearing of the facts, where you can be adjudged guilty or innocent based on the actual facts and evidence of the matter. So we want to maintain a special appearance. We want to maintain our challenge until it is adequately answered by the state. Therefore, I could not sign, in good conscience, I could not sign that waiver of counsel.
So what was your alternative?
Well, that's the question. The alternative at first, now this is the first time. It's not the first time that the waiver of counsel has ever been an issue for any of our citizens. That has been an issue for a while. Typically, what usually occurs, however, as far as I'm aware, is that the waiver of counsel is usually refused by the defendant or the respondent, as we choose to refer to ourselves. And the judge will often argue back and forth, and it's resolved in various ways, most of the time by the judge simply signing it and entering it for you on your behalf. You don't have to consent to it that way, and you can dispute it later because you didn't put your signature on it. But the problem with that, of course, from our point of view, is still that, you know, it was entered on our behalf, and they feel that they then have the authority to proceed to trial.
Wow. It makes you wonder why there's a point in even signing anything if you're just forced to do it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there is that question. But this judge, he tried a different tactic, and it was a little surprising and pretty frustrating. But so he tried to get me to sign it by ultimately, I guess you could say, threatening. He warned me, he threatened me with, however you want to phrase it, he advised me that if I did not sign the waiver, I was going to be looking at a pretrial hearing, not on the jurisdiction of the state, but on whether or not I had waived my right to counsel.
So day one, just to wrap that up, you were there for how long were you there for day one?
Well, I was there all day. They told us that
like 9 in the morning to like 9 in the morning to 5 in the evening, you were in court.
Yeah, but court didn't actually open until like 11:30, almost 12. So okay. We were only in the courtroom half a day.
And he called you up there several times. Do you have an attorney? What, you know, the whole representation question, and that pretty much took up the whole day.
Yeah.
Over and over again.
Took up all 3 days. Yeah.
Wow. So today was that pretrial hearing, right?
It was supposed to be. That was where we left off yesterday afternoon, and that was Tuesday afternoon. We left off with him telling me to be back at 9:30 in the morning on Wednesday today, and that he was going to have that hearing. We went through the whole first half of the day, and he never even called me up. But we did, after lunch, I was the second or third person to be called, and he pretty much said that he had been doing some research and considering his options, and that he had come to the conclusion a judge is supposed to use extreme discretion, I think was how he put it, in exercising his power to move to a hearing on whether or not someone had forfeited their right to counsel. And he wanted to exercise that extreme discretion. So he basically started all over as if he'd never seen me in court before, read my charges, their penalties, all of that, and then re-advised me of my right to counsel in the way that they do, and then asked me, what do you want to do about counsel? To which, of course, I replied that, you know, my initial reply, exactly the same. I don't know at this point because the state still hasn't responded to my jurisdictional challenge.
So what ended up happening with this form?
Yeah, he after that he said, well, whether you want to challenge jurisdiction or not, you still need to answer the question of whether or not you want an attorney. I basically said to him, well, if I can sign the form and, you know, notate on it or put a notation above my signature that I'll reserve my right, then I'll sign it.
So your idea is to comply as much within the limits that you know of, because to get to your ultimate goal, which is for the state, you actually want the state to reply to this challenge. I mean, ultimately.
Of course I do. I mean, that's exactly what we're after here, is we want the state to prove jurisdiction before they do anything else.
Yeah, and they only have to do that one time.
They do, yeah. I mean, if they'll do it one time, that's something they seem to be unwilling to do even once. But
there was some kind of an issue with when you submit all your evidence and so forth.
I told you earlier that we serve notice on the DA, and once we've served notice on the DA, then I can file paperwork with the court. And the DA's office, and I've filed paperwork with them four times now. And the DA's office every single time has told me, now this is just Stanley County, this is not statewide, other people have had better experiences. But this DA's office has told me each time that I'm not supposed to file paperwork with them or serve anything to them. They don't take anything, apparently, from anybody, they say. Hmm. What they want me to do is just take what I've got and go file it in the clerk's office, and they tell me they'll get a copy.
Okay.
That's not how notice works, so I keep filing notice with them every time I need to, every time it's required.
So you're trying to file it also with the DA?
I am, first and foremost, with the DA, yes.
Yeah, okay.
They got this glass window in front of their little secretarial station there at the front.
Okay.
And the first two times, they just verbally refused and kept trying to hand it back. I wouldn't take it back, and I told them, you've been served, and there's your notice, and I said, have a good day, and I'd go on my way. But apparently, they've gotten to the point now where they don't want to take anything at all from me. So this glass window is a barrier between us, and I went up this time to file my paperwork. It was actually Tuesday morning, the day after my first court date, because I had revisions to make. So I went to file my addendum and my notice to them. And the secretary, who is not an ADA, she's just a secretary inside, opened the window about 6 or 8 inches and asked me what she could do for me. And I had a question for her. I said, y'all have been telling me, you know, not to file stuff with you, not to bring any paperwork here. And I can respect that and you know, comply with that. If you'll show me where is the process by which, in writing now, I want to see it written out somewhere, that this is the proper process, that what y'all are telling me to do, which is contradictory to standard legal procedure, is actually the proper process for this courthouse in this county.
Hmm.
So to that question, she said, well, you know, let me go in the back and ask, and I'll be right back. And I said, okay. So she went back, talked to somebody, came back out, and told me, and this, to the best of my recollection, this is pretty much a verbatim response, was that I could look in the general statutes for the procedure on serving legal notice and all that, but that their internal policies, which, by the way, their internal policy is what they keep telling me I'm violating, their internal policies for the courthouse do not have to be disclosed to anyone.
Wow.
So I asked her, how is that helpful to me? If your policies on, you know, the service of notice and all that and how y'all acquire paperwork that you need, if all that doesn't have to be disclosed, then how am I supposed to know if what I'm doing is actually the right thing to be doing? And her response to me, again, pretty much verbatim, was, you know, that's all I was told, and I can't really tell you anything else. I don't know.
But this lady eventually, from what I've heard, and you've told me, essentially secretary, that you're trying to get this paperwork to, she actually showed up during your appearance. Is that right? She made a claim.
One of the ADAs did on her behalf.
Okay.
But yes, basically, she did. She made a claim that I injured her.
Really?
What happened? Well, I don't mean to laugh. I hate that the lady got a paper cut, but I highly doubt that it was a paper cut she got from anything I gave her. But that's kind of just an aside. What happened was that after she gave me that last response that, you know, she couldn't give me any more information, that was the answer she'd gotten, and that was all there was she could tell me. I did two things simultaneously. One was verbal, the other was an actual physical action. The verbal response that I began was basically, well, in that case, and as I was saying that, I pulled out the service of notice, or the notice and addendum that I had for them that day, which was in an envelope that had no sharp edges, no sharp paper edges exposed at all. It was an Office Max envelope. And
okay.
Anyway, pulled that out of my attaché case as I was speaking and stuck it through the window, which she, again, only had open about 6 inches. So I got it like probably 85% of the way through the window, and she shut the window on me, and all this happened very quickly.
Mm-hmm. So she slammed the window on you.
She did on the paperwork. Actually, she was in the process of closing the window on the paperwork, but she didn't want the paperwork in there. So she took her other hand, I guess it'd be her right hand, and she pushed the paperwork back out the window. And in order to do that, of course, she had to open the window a little bit again. And she no sooner got it out of the window than she removed her hand from the paperwork and immediately proceeded to try to shut the window completely again. But right before she could shut the window, I sort of tossed it just a little, you know, right through without getting my hand in the way so I wouldn't get my hand smashed. I tossed the packet in there on the desk, like, what, 8 or 12 inches into the office.
Now, that's not how they described it.
No, that is not how the lady described it, the ADA, that morning at all. Basically, she slammed the window, and this is kind of interesting, too. When she slammed the window as the paperwork landed on her desk all at the same time, she basically exclaimed the F word. I won't repeat it, but it was almost comical because she was, wow, it was funny the way, but as she did that, you know, I said through the window, "You've been served," about the time she just went F. And, anyway, so that was the end of the actual encounter. I proceeded to go to the clerk's office and file the remaining paperwork with them and then went to court. And they had one person in front of me who, ironically, had been put in contempt of court and jailed for 24 hours the day before for cursing in court. That's the irony of the statement that she made.
During your appearance, no, she didn't bring it up. You said who somebody brought it up for her?
Yeah, the ADA that was, doing the cases actually called my name second. The ADA introduced me to the judge by saying, and next on the docket, we've got Mr. Townsend. And before we address Mr. Townsend's issues from the calendar here, whatever my charges were, we have an issue we need to address pertaining to Mr. Townsend's conduct, I think was how she stated it. And then her assistant, or another ADA, I don't know this other lady's name, stood up and gave the account of what I had allegedly done. And she went into this monologue to the judge about how I had been warned on several occasions that I was not to bring any paperwork to the DA's office, that they don't take anything there, and how I continue to obstinately or stubbornly return repeatedly filing things with them, and they don't do that. And then she said I had come to the DA's office that morning and demanded to know and see in writing what their policy was, which is not true. I made no demands, simply inquired, and that I had gotten irate, which is completely not true, when I was told that their policies didn't have to be disclosed. And the next part of it was that I had launched the paperwork. Her exact words, I had launched paperwork.
Launched?
Yeah, like a rocket or something, I guess. But, so in the process of doing that, apparently, this poor secretary had been injured by my launching paperwork into their office.
Okay.
He completely neglected the whole issue of slamming the window on me and all of that, the reaction of the secretary was completely glossed over or omitted. And certainly the cursing was not mentioned. But, you know, ultimately this really just goes to show how they were trying to defame me in front of the judge, to discredit me, make me look like a liar.
It's really a crazy situation, Milo. I mean, when I first heard all this, I thought, man, I mean, you could not write some of this stuff. And there's more to it. I mean, we're not even done with the whole thing yet, but it's just unbelievable.
Really, it's comical, but it is a tragicomedy. And people should be mad.
Yeah.
If people knew and experienced this, and just had to go through it, they would be so, so upset that this is the way that this government, these courts, treat people. They know that they don't have a leg to stand on, lawfully speaking, so they resort to abuse and avoidance of the issues, and they basically resort to fraud and intimidation, ultimately, is what it amounts to, in order to, quote, keep people in line and make people comply and submit to their authority, their alleged authority.
So, Milo, you're trying to stand up for the Constitution, essentially. And so far, it looks like you've run into issues from even having your challenge being heard. They stick at the attorney question. Then you've had an injury, a paper cut slammed in your face by this other lady. Now, there's one more part to the story, though, that I want people to hear, because this is just, I mean, it's like you said, it's sad, but it's just icing on the cake. And in this, something that I would say is just this abuse of the judicial system.
You want me to tell about the whistling sheriff's deputy?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, there was a whistling sheriff's deputy. I want to talk about that whistling sheriff's deputy. We'll be back right after this. All right, I'm back with Milo Townsend. This is Cliff Muncy with the North Carolina American Republic, and Milo Townsend is a citizen in the Republic. And we've just gone over what seems to be an obstruction of justice. Milo, you've gone into court today, yesterday, and the day before, and it seems that really all you're trying to do is get the state to answer a challenge to its own jurisdiction. You're challenging the jurisdiction of what you would say is the de facto state of North Carolina, which doesn't have jurisdiction over you because you don't recognize the constitutionality of Reconstruction. We've gone over the first and second day. Of course, the judge has sort of stopped your challenge. We also have the secretary at the ADA's office who refused to accept your paperwork and then claimed that she got injured by that because she got a paper cut from you giving your paperwork to her. Milo, this is turning out to be an interesting series of events. What happened on your last day? I want to get to this because something happened when you left. All of your stuff was done. You left. This was yesterday. They let out of court, and this was, of course, at the end of the day, and everybody was leaving, all the court officers and everything, right?
Yeah, it was right at just after 5 o'clock, like maybe, you know, 5 or 10 minutes after five. So the whole courthouse is clearing out pretty much.
Okay, so you're in your car, you're getting ready to leave, drive out of the parking lot, and you're with somebody else.
Right.
And
now, not in my vehicle. A friend of mine, who's also a citizen of the Republic, had come to support me during my court session and be a witness to the event. And she was there as well in the parking lot in her own vehicle, and she was pulling out in front of me to leave. But, what happened, the brief version of it here is that there's a bailiff that was in the courtroom all day with me, and well, every day really, and he had come out the back door of the courthouse. Like I said earlier, I've got no ill intent towards law enforcement officers. I really don't, and I understand their job and their duties, and I understand that generally speaking they don't have any knowledge of most of the stuff that we speak about, but this one had been present to hear everything I'd had to say for basically, you know, a day and a half, day and three quarters there in court. So, at any rate, he's a sheriff's deputy, a bailiff, walks out the back door as I'm pulling out, and you got to understand a bit about the geography of the courthouse. I'll try to keep this simple. The courthouse is on the same side of the street as the sheriff's department, and they are adjacent to one another. And the sheriff's department is right beside, on the same side as the exit part of the driveway. So you have this one-way horseshoe kind of thing that goes around from the street on one side of the courthouse, around the back of the parking lot, and then back out to the street on the other. And it's that exit from the courthouse is on the same side as the sheriff's department. Their parking lots are literally adjoining. Mm. So I'm walking I'm driving my vehicle, and of course, as I stated earlier, I do not have DMV-issued tags on my vehicle. I have a plate that is actually lawful in our state. It's a North Carolina American Republic license plate. And so that's displayed, you know, very prominently in the same place that any license plate's displayed. But it's not legal to them, in their opinion. Well, the sheriff's deputy, as I pass him pulling out of the parking lot, he sees it, I assume. And while I can't absolutely, definitively prove that he is the one I heard, my windows were down, and it sounded like the whistle that I heard came from where he was just after I passed him and the rear of my vehicle came into view. So I assume and I strongly believe that he whistled. Upon this whistle, which was like a I'm trying to get your attention sort of whistle, I see a highway patrolman. He is standing in the parking lot beside a black police vehicle, solid black unmarked police car.
So it was the bailiff that whistled to get the attention of the officer?
That is my belief. Yeah, I believe the bailiff whistled, got the attention of the state trooper, and I assume pointed or somehow indicated at my vehicle in a manner that would communicate, you know, this is the one or something of that nature.
Hmm.
Now, I mean, again, I can't prove these things. I can't absolutely prove it, but you know how sometimes things just, you know, they only make sense when you consider one explanation. Otherwise, there's too many coincidences, really.
Yeah.
So anyhow, this upon the whistle, this highway patrolman gets into his vehicle, cranks it up, and pulls up to the exit on the same, you know, right beside the exit of the courthouse, same side of the road there, and waits. And the other person in front of me, she's waiting to turn, and I'm waiting to turn. We're both going to make a left turn and go past this highway patrolman where he's sitting at the exit of the sheriff's department's parking lot. I just knew he was going to pull me. And sure enough, I pulled out, made my left turn, got into the lane of traffic, and I did so right in front of, and by right in front, I mean maybe like 40 to 50 yards in front of a black pickup that's coming down the road. When I do, this black car, the police car, with the highway patrolman driving it, literally forces his way out of the driveway into my lane of traffic that I've entered into between me and the black truck, which is now probably 15 to 20 yards behind me. I mean, maybe 25. There's really, it was not safe, but he wanted to be behind me. And he made a great effort to be right behind me. As soon as he did, I approached a stoplight that was red, so I stopped and put my turn signal on and made a right-hand turn, and he didn't even stop for the red light. He came right behind me, right through it, and turned his blue lights on and pulled me over. So, you know, in the end, he wound up writing me tickets, and to his credit, he seemed like a very fair officer. He had been in court with us for an entire day, and I had sat through his testimony through a pretrial hearing and other issues. I had heard the man testify, and I had seen him all day long. He had heard everything I said. So, in a way, I guess you could say we kind of had already met one another, although we didn't, you know, introduce, shake hands or whatever. We knew who each other were. And there he goes and pulls me over, writes me tickets, and eventually, of course, let me go. But, you know, it's just strange to me. And maybe it shouldn't be strange, but it is. It's strange to me the kind of behavior that evinces.
So really, I mean, it's the same issue that you were in court for. He ticketed you for again.
Right.
That day, when the same day that you were in court, and he knew you were in court.
Well, that I was already in court to deal with these very issues. Yeah, he gave me tickets for the exact same thing. Well, not the resisting. There was nothing to for him to give me a resisting charge on. He didn't arrest me or anything, but mean, I was polite and courteous to him, of course. I try to always be. I think the night with the roadblock in Locust was just a bad night for me. It was late. I was tired. I was pretty worked up about some things already, and things didn't go very well for anybody that night. But I always try to be very courteous with them. And I didn't even have a firearm at the time in the vehicle when this gentleman pulled me over, so there was no issue with that. And he just wrote me tickets and then let me go. Of course, it was pouring down rain, and he literally told me he didn't want to get wet. He just handed me the tickets and ran back to his car because it was raining cats and dogs. But if the weather had been better, it could have been, you know, a more prolonged encounter. So in a way, maybe, you know, the rain was a blessing.
Well, I know you can't confirm, like you said, you can't totally 100% confirm that this bailiff whistled for this officer to pull you over. But if you could, and if you look at that whole situation and you consider the brevity of that, you consider this woman this person that's testifying that you gave her a paper cut and that you were I forget what the wording you used, belligerent or demanding,
and irate. One other word that she used,
And you've got the judge that doesn't want to go forward, and you've got all of our past experience that shows that the state just do not want to answer this question. You know, you really have to consider all these things, and there's a doctrine. I think it's called the chilling effect doctrine. Can you explain a little bit about what that is?
Well, the chilling effect is any practice or behavior that the court engages in, or I guess you could even extend it to the court and the state generally, which would be, you know, police officers and all, if you want to consider the experience of a whistling deputy or whatever. But basically, it's any behavior that agents of the state engage in that causes a person or is intended to cause a person to not elect to exercise their constitutional rights. So when a state disapproves of your behavior, but they don't want to outright prohibit you from being able to exercise a constitutional right, they resort to intimidation, really. And that can take many forms, but ultimately the bottom line is that they intimidate you or attempt to intimidate you into compliance. And I mean, this has, you know, case law to back it up and all that as well. It's a legal doctrine that even the de facto state recognizes. So this isn't just some made up something that we're, you know, talking about here. It's very real in law. They're engaging in it.
Yeah. Well, Milo, I appreciate you filling me in on this story. There's some shocking things going on. So you've got another date coming up, another court date coming up, right?
I do. Our challenge, hopefully, will be, it'll be addressed in early October.
So what do you want folks to do? What can I do, what can we do to help you prepare for this thing and help bring some success to the argument that we're trying to press forward to get the state to answer?
Well, you know, if someone believes in lawful government and is able and willing to, and I mean this is a personal decision, of course, but is able and willing to make the sacrifices necessary, the first and foremost, the biggest help, I guess, would be to, you know, research it, become familiar with what we're all about and why we are all about it, and, you know, alter your citizenship, become a state citizen. But that's a big step, and I know a lot of people aren't able to do that. So the second best thing to do, if you believe in what the Republic and its citizens are trying to fight for, would be, you know, we need money and we need supporters. Even if those supporters remain de facto citizens, national citizens, we still need supporters, people to come out to the court sessions that we have, people to support us, people that have any kind of resources to offer as far as, you know, help with legal research, if it's just public awareness or public relations, so to speak, people that want to procure a Patriot packet, I guess you could call it, a citizenship packet or whatever. We've got materials. The North Carolina Republic has all kinds of brochures, bumper stickers, whatever, advertised for us. And I say advertise, it's not a money-making thing. Most of us are just working, ordinary people. But ultimately, we need people, and we need money. So if you want to make a donation, by all means, feel free to donate to the Legal Fund or just the Republic in general. You can go to our website. It's the official state website, and there's a link on there where people can donate money to different aspects of the state and its mission, and those are pretty much it.
And I think a big part of this too is education, right, Milo? Because I think there's a huge group of people on one side who want to fight all of those modern day issues like the NDAA and the privacy concerns and all of that, but they don't realize the root of it is their citizenship was nationalized by these Reconstruction Acts. And these Reconstruction Acts and the Civil War, that whole time period is sort of covered up in our history, and not a lot of people know about it. So I'll plug this website real quick. AmericasRemedy.com is a good site to go to. That's AmericasRemedy.com. And that's the educational part. People can invite John Ainsworth and different people out to actually talk about this stuff and sort of give a history lesson on what happened with Reconstruction, how it affected our states, our citizenship, our rights. And then, of course, ncrepublic.org, like you were saying, you can donate there. You can actually donate to the court cost and the various costs that citizens go through when they're trying to push this argument through.
Yeah, because, you know, as a person going through it, you know, someone who's actually in court, they pay for all this stuff, you know, filings and copies and ink and paper and lose time off work and all of that. They pay for all of that, you know, out of their own pocket. And if they're arrested or whatnot in the process, of course, the bail and all that comes out of their own pocket too. So
yeah,
absolutely, any kind of help is appreciated. And those are the biggest options right there. So I would just say that if you value liberty and if you value lawful government, this is definitely a worthy cause. It's a nonviolent cause. We're not interested in any kind of violence or that, you know, any kind of solution, so-called solution like that. We stay very, very far away from any of that. This is definitely all done through the law, peaceably, through diplomacy and the court.
Well, again, Milo, thank you for what you're doing, and I know I appreciate it, and I hope others recognize the value of someone like you standing up for this. And I'll just leave people with your next court date again was October. What was that date?
It's October the 6th, actually, is the exact date.
October the 6th.
They have given me now.
And these are available. These are open to the public, right?
Oh yeah, courts. Well, I say courts always, but actually there have been times that they've asked everybody to leave that's not a defendant, but those times are really, you know, rare when it's most crowded. But yeah, generally speaking, court is open to the public, and I know it's not a whole lot for entertainment, but it would definitely be an eye-opening and a learning experience for people who are unfamiliar or, you know, even only moderately familiar with how that process actually works in the real world.
And where is that going to be located?
My court sessions right now going on are in Stanley County, and it's downtown Albemarle. I think it's 2nd Street, but I could be mistaken about that. They Google Stanley County Courthouse, and they'll have a link. You know, Google has a link to everything.
Well, Milo, thank you very much, and hopefully we'll have a chance to catch up with you later and see how this is going along.
Well, thank you, Cliff. I appreciate the opportunity to tell my story, and I hope that it opens some people's eyes and helps people see what kind of world we really live in and, you know, animates some people to take action that they may otherwise have not taken.
Absolutely. All right, folks, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up here. Remember, visit ncrepublic.org. This is the state, North Carolina American Republic, the reestablished de jure state of North Carolina, and also America's Remedy. The educational side, this is americasremedy.com. Thank you for joining us. Have a great day.